Welcome, welcome. And don't worry, we have started, so we'll have the conversation as it unfolds. So, Niven or Niven?
Niven.
Yeah.
Exactly. So a couple of weeks ago, which is like maybe 2 weeks ago, I had a coffee with the person who brought us together, whom we owe a fur coat.
Colleen's very much a fur coat person, not. But yes, I saw her and Mike about 3 weeks ago for his birthday. Ach, it was so lovely.
Yeah, so I said to her, well, I think when I next speak to Niven, I'm going to say to her, we owe you a fur coat. Because just to think about even how this conversation started, right? Because this was Colleen saying, I know somebody, you should meet her. You and I speak, we connect. And then later, you are now connecting me to another woman. I'm like, I do think that the world becomes a wonderful place when smart, kind-hearted women just get together. I guess part of the welcome to the conversation is welcome. This is the official welcome to Future Readiness. We used to have the same platform. It was called Coming Full Circle. And I realized that Coming Full Circle almost made people think that once you reach the end, you're done. You can just knock off. But I was persuaded to look at it as a conversation about the future. So how do we invite people who can drop pearls of wisdom about where the future is actually anything after this moment, right? Yeah. So welcome, welcome, welcome. So I'm not going to butcher anything about your accomplishments. It's entirely up to you to tell us who Niven is. Like, how do you answer the question when people go, who's Niven? Besides saying I'm fierce and I'm fabulous and I'm smart and I'm a connector of people.
Gosh, somebody asked me to describe myself the other day in one word. Interesting. So I think, who I am is somebody who feels like she's in the prime of her life, doing exactly what she wants, in the way that she wants, with the people that she wants. Really relishing all that I already know, but constantly excited about what I'll still know. And delighted and grateful for all that I have experienced and looking forward to what I still get to experience, both personally and in work, you know. So as work, from a work point of view, I work as a strategy and culture consultant. I'm a lecturer, I'm an author, and I'm also busy pursuing my PhD. So in 3 years' time, you can call me Doctor too.
Oh, I shall remember this, Dr. Posma. I look forward to that opportunity. But, I think just borrowing from my own experience of studying and working, right? It was the balancing act. There came a time where I said to myself, why do I even need this PhD? Like, who am I doing it for? This is too painful. Da, 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 da. I'd say these things and get myself into a hole. And the way that I got myself out of that hole was by, I think it was a quote from Muhammad Ali. And he said, I hated every minute of training, but I reminded myself that I'd rather suffer now so I could live the rest of my life like a champion.
Ah, oh, lovely.
So I offer that to you for the moments to come.
Thank you. Yeah, he has some real gems, and that's one that I haven't heard before, so I love it. Thank you.
So now walk us through your transition. So you do these wonderful, amazing things in a corporatized environment, and then you end up doing what you want, the way you want, with whom you want, at the pace at which you want. How was that transition, and what was that transition?
Yeah, so interestingly, it wasn't as much of a transition as on the face of it, it may appear, or I may have made it sound, because I know when I backed myself a few years ago to start working for myself, but not just for a few years in between big executive roles, but for the next 20 or 30 years. A friend of mine said to me, oh, well, thank heavens you're out of corporate because now you can start living your real life. And I said, well, you know, actually I can understand that was your experience. It wasn't mine. So all of my roles, which have been in corporate, have been in the public sector, have been in the not-for-profit sector, all of them were very consciously chosen, you know, and every one of them felt and still feels like the most profound privilege and an opportunity and a vehicle to really express my purpose and to figure out what my purpose might be, you know, because I don't think it's this thing that is preordained and you have to try to discover it. No, you invent it in the work that you're doing. And so all of the roles that I took on were deeply meaningful to me and were far more about, far more than just moving things from an inbox to an outbox and paying the bills. And that said, about 4 years ago when I left Standard Bank and I was thinking, okay, well, now what? It just suddenly occurred to me, and it really was the first time. Mm-hmm. Hold on. You know, if I take on another role, as wonderful as it is, as many opportunities as I'll have to do things in this role, there'll be trade-offs, which now suddenly for the first time feel like trade-offs. And the trade-offs around autonomy and variety, I've never considered a problem before because that's the deal. You get paid to do a job. You get all kinds of support for that, and you give up some things in response. And all of a sudden I thought, now I think if I take on another role, it'll feel like I'm not able to breathe. And so I have to listen to that. And so, okay, if I want to be working for the next 20 or 30 years of my life, which I do, I mean, I want to be one of these wise old birds wandering around, hopefully not in a caftan. But, you know, I've got things to offer, I've got things to learn, and I get to do it. I don't got to do it, I get to.
Yes.
But why would I want to stop that at some arbitrary age on a calendar and just sit on a stoop and think, okay, well, that's it, you know? And of course, that's not something you get to do when you're working for somebody else. I mean, there are very particular dates on calendars, and they're preordained from the moment you start working in that organization, be it a company, be it a public sector, be it whatever. And I thought, no, time to back myself and double down. So what does this look like? And that's pretty much where I started in the last 4 years, and touch wood, the next 20 years have been great.
So how did day one feel? Day one of I'm betting on myself now. So this is day one. I can't pick up the phone and call IT and say the printer isn't working, right? How did that feel?
So, you know, I have done this before. And I must say, other times it felt a lot more overwhelming. That feeling of 360-degree stress, you know, there's nothing to stand on. I didn't feel it this time, and I haven't felt it this time, because something feels like it's quite fundamentally shifted in terms of this being the long haul rather than a filling time, in terms of how much I know and the resources I've got at my disposal to actually do the things that I want. And friends of mine were really struck in the first few weeks and months when I already said, no, I'm not taking on that piece of work because I really don't want to. God forbid in a country and a world where people are just grateful for a job, any job, that I sound arrogant. I don't mean to if I do, and I don't feel arrogant. What I feel is clear. This is what I want to do. This is what I'm good at doing. This is not what I want to do or am good at doing. So why distract myself? Why dissipate the possibility and the energy? Let me rather give that opportunity to us for somebody else. And of course, that's quite a big thing to figure out as an entrepreneur, because you're never quite sure where the next thing is going to come in. So just grab it. And this time I haven't felt that. And it's been very, very, very interesting to contrast it this time to the previous two, three times that I had my own business. The sense of clarity and the sense of commitment and the sense of stuff that I bring, chalk and cheese.
Isn't that amazing? Because I remember I had my first stab at independence just after I left tourism. And it was a 4-year spell. And then I went back into taking people's money on a regular basis on the 20th of every month. And I've now been independent for 10 years. And I have a shared sense with you that this time feels like I was okay with the choice and consequence. Because I always think of these things as choice and consequence, right? So, because for every black t-shirt you wear, you haven't worn the pink one or the white one or whatever. And I've just had to say to myself, are the consequences of my choices things that I'm happy to live with? Because the minute you get to that point, then you have what you're talking about, right? Which is this level of clarity that says, that's for me, that's not for me. The zeros may be tempting because it means I could travel 3 times a year, but I don't want to do it at the expense of my heart or at the expense of my joy, right? So what exactly are you doing now that you are now 4 years into it and day one was okay? What are you doing now?
Yeah, so I just want to add to what you've just said before I answer your question. The one thing is I'm struck at how many people's remuneration is literally compensation. I mean, you
Yes.
are being compensated
Yes.
for all the things you don't do because you want to, but you're too scared.
Yes.
And, I mean, guys, you know, take your cue from that.
Yes.
And the second thing is, yeah, for you, it's about choice and consequences. For me, it's about choice and risk. And there's two kinds of risk actually in the world. The risk that bad things will happen. Okay, we get that. But there's actually technically another kind of risk, and it's the risk that good things will not happen.
Yes.
And we don't think about it. It doesn't even enter our frame of reference or our language. And so, yeah, choice, consequences, trade-offs, risks. So what I do now is I have some anchor clients in the strategy space, and they're lovely. And so I do a fair amount of work for them. I do a lot of lecturing on office politics, on leadership development programs, particularly women's leadership development programs. I mean, the stuff is relevant to anyone and everyone in my experience, but
yeah.
there is an extra bit of nuance and an extra bit of power in women really getting this stuff. I write, so I have a number of outlets, publications that I write for. And I am a PhD student. So once a month, I go off to the University of Pretoria with my rucksack on and my tackies and sit and listen to all manner of things in this PhD of organizational behavior.
Well, but why did you choose this organizational space to be the place where you deposit everything you've learned, but also everything that you want to continue to learn? Because I'm finding that we have organizations are older than you and I, but still the conversations around how do we make them positive? How do we keep people switched on? And what is the caliber of leadership we're looking for? Like, so why did this feel like a space you wanted to go into? What was missing in what's being offered?
Yeah, so it's funny, hey, you know, that idea from Kierkegaard that life has to be lived back forwards, but can only be understood backwards. You know, I had a slightly different experience to you. For me, there's no push to get a PhD.
Yes.
None of my clients care.
Yes.
No, you're great just as you are. But there was a very strong pull. And all of a sudden, I think 10 years after I finished my master's, I was and I am deeply intrigued by the question that will form a research topic. I haven't formulated it exactly yet. That's what this year is about. But it's broadly about trying to understand in a bigger and richer and more helpful way quite how the processes of strategy and power interact in organizations. Because most of my career I've been in strategy consulting.
Yes.
And there is this tendency to think, well, you hire the guys that are smart, they come up with the best answer, and the best answer speaks for itself. Well, no, not quite how it works, you know. There's always a gap. There's a gap between the answer that gets put on the table and a gap between the answer that's put on the table and what actually happens.
Yes.
And those gaps are all about power, all about politics. And we have a very single, simple, dangerously limited understanding and story of politics. They are actually much richer and broader and potentially positive than many of us realize. And so how we can move from the purely analytical to the relational and put them together in a way that helps, I think would be fascinating. Because, you know, Rose Beth Moss Kanter said in the 70s, I mean, a lifetime ago, a different world, that power and politics are the last dirty secrets of organizations. We don't talk about them, and we definitely don't teach people about them. So how might we do that with things that matter? Because you're never going to escape them. They're absolutely everywhere. And yet we pretend that, or we think, that a meritocracy and power are mutually exclusive. No. But don't get me started. I could get on my soapbox.
No. I want you to, because this is the stuff that is important for people to think about. So the people in our community are either leaders or self-starters or entrepreneurs or people who are at senior positions in their own organizations. And what I'm loving about this is piercing the bubbles of what we have held as sacred truths, right? I love this idea that, firstly, you've just said, it's not reward, it's called compensation for a reason, so pay attention. So the second piece is, politics are a function of being alive, right? I think Desmond Tutu used to say that, like, politics is not you are a politician because you're an elected official. By definition of being a human being, you are a political being because you function in a society, right? But I'm interested in how you would define the term politics, because where I come from, and in the earlier stages of my career, when we defined someone as political in the organization, it was always with inverted marks, right? As in, they are using their influence to negatively gain an unfair advantage. How do you define politics?
Yes, interestingly as well, in the literature, there's been a big change in the last 20 years, because certainly in the academic literature, that pretty much was politics.
Yeah.
It's self-serving at the expense of others,
yes.
Behavior. That really isn't very pleasant, and most people would think thanks, but no thanks. And exactly, calling somebody political is hardly a compliment.
Yeah.
And in the last 20 or so years, it shifted to say, but hold on, there is actually far more to this in the sphere and the nature of the informal. And so the definition that I really like and that I use and refer to is, it's the range of things that happen in the informal, unofficial, sometimes behind the scenes spaces in organizations, to get power, to give power, to get information, to give information, support, you know, all of the things that are not written down anywhere. And what I always say to people is, look, every team, department, organization's got two parts to it. The formal, the visible, the stuff that you see in the organogram, in the governance reports, the standard operating procedures, et cetera, et cetera. That, of course, that's real.
Yeah.
Of course, it's powerful and it's incredibly important. But just as real and powerful and important is this informal. And you don't see a process or a policy for that anywhere, and yet it's everywhere.
Yeah.
And in that space, there's all manner of opportunities in terms of how you play. Of course, you can be self-serving and Machiavellian, or you can be perfectly ethical and constructive in how you use what, in my experience, are the four pillars of politics and political intelligence, and therefore your political capital.
Yes.
So it's about your power, i.e. your ability to get things done.
Yes.
It's about your strategic relationships.
Yes.
It's about your reputation. You know, the reputation that precedes you through an organization, through a society, and then your influence. You know, if power is the formal part, influence is the informal part. And those four building blocks are yours to use as you wish, to build up or to ignore. But I always say to people, look, if they choose not to get involved in politics, it's your life, it's your career, make whatever choice you want. But make sure that it's an informed choice. That when you're saying I'm opting out of politics, you understand there's a whole spectrum of things that you're opting out of here.
Yes.
Understand the risks and the consequences. And I think the best metaphor is to say, well, making that choice is essentially like choosing to play tennis on half the court, you know, soccer on half the field.
Yes.
Because those two parts are as important in organizations and, frankly, in highly politicized organizations. The informal completely drowns out the formal.
But how are you finding that female leaders are dealing with all this stuff, right? Because somewhere in that mix is also this idea that you've got relational power and effective power, right? So people tend to stereotype relational power with females. So this is how women lead, which is why when there's a crisis of faith, you put a woman. If there's a crisis of profit, you put a guy, right? So I'm wondering whether in your work you are finding one of the nuances could be how female leaders are just responding to the issues of how their own leadership style has been given this identity of relational versus effective. Is that coming across at all?
Actually, I read an article for my PhD around that, about the double-edged sword of women being seen as relational, and whether there was a pushback against this, and whether it was, first of all, true, and second of all, whether it harmed them or helped them.
Yeah.
I must go back and reread it, because now you're making me think about it some more. But in my experience, there's a couple of things. And I think, you know, this opportunity, this challenge for all people to develop both political will and from their political skill is a big one. I mean, because these myths of office politics that I've written about, they're as widespread as they are wrong, and they're as mistaken as they are naive.
Yeah.
And often I get expressions of regret from people and this is across the board, but generally more senior people saying, you know, I wish I'd known this stuff at the beginning of my career. If I'd known this 20 years ago, things could have been very different. And I can only say, well, if I'd known this 20 years ago, and I've had a great career, but gosh, the times when I was hitting my head against a brick wall.
Yes.
And I think for women, there's a couple of things, but the one slide that I have, which often gets a lot of discussion and debate, is a quote from Sally Krawcheck from the US, a very successful entrepreneur. And she says, the single biggest mistake she's seen women make at work is that we treat work like school.
Yes.
So we think if we put our head down and work really hard, somebody's going to notice and they're going to give us an A.
Yes.
And, you know, I think that's one of the shadow sides of the fact that girls generally do better at school and at university. They get higher marks, they graduate in higher numbers, not universally, but generally.
Yes.
Is what works for us for the first 20, 25 years of our life, the rules change at work and nobody tells you that. And so you carry on because of your success at school, because of how we are socialized to be more communal rather than individual, you know, it can come as a hell of a shock 20 years later to suddenly realize, hold on, the rules changed and nobody told me. To see things that you don't understand and to try to walk away from the immediate knee-jerk reaction of, no, no, that's self-serving and that's not nice and that's not what I would do. Okay, well, how am I going to be more effective in this situation? Because it's not just my technical skills. It's not just working hard and hoping for an A. I mean, talent matters, hard work matters, but they're not enough.
Yes.
You need that power, those relationships, the influence, and the reputation. And I think women, one of the challenges for many women, not all women and not only women, of course.
Yes.
The challenges for many women is to see relationships sometimes purely as transactional. You need this, I need this. Okay, well, let's do it. To have relationships that you need to take something from, you can't necessarily give back. And I think, look, if that's all you're doing, if all of your relationships and your entire network is extractive and only for you, you've got a problem.
Yes.
But sometimes it is just functional and transactional. And you can pick up the phone call, pick up a phone to somebody after 10 years and say, look, this is what's happening.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of the research in terms of how women see relationships is we've got to deeply invest in them before we can withdraw from them. And that's beautiful. And heaven knows the world needs more of that. But there are other options as well. And a lot of that comes as firstly a big surprise to women. And then I can almost visibly see them think, oh, no, but that doesn't feel nice. And to try to not just intellectually, but viscerally get past the distaste, you know.
It's and you're raising so many interesting things because several things have happened for me. I came from the school that said, my work must speak for me. Because speaking about my work is not the thing. Please understand this comes from a brand builder. So the idea that...
I don't love irony. Oh, it's fabulous.
That contradiction is not lost on me. I'm like, really? Nah, this is like... So that was the first piece. And then the second piece is this thing that says, our family dynamics, we have to start making room for how they impact the way we lead. Right. So if you are the last born in your family and nobody ever listens to you, you get to the world of work and you still remain stumm because you think, I don't know how to use my voice. I don't even know if I have a voice. If you are the one in the family who's the first generation, which happens with many people, including myself, you're the first one to go to university to have some level of material and reputational success. You then take that leadership role and you assume that that's how you can function in the world. So you come into the world of work and you truly just power ahead. But you're powering ahead in a community where other females were socialized to get along and move at the pace of the collective. So I'm interested in just what you think we should be doing, parents, teachers, aunts, godmothers, all of these elements of human beings who support and can see a growing girl child. What are the new conversations we should be having? Because by the time I get to the corner office, I'm fully grown. and it becomes a process of unlearning versus learning. So what in your view do you think people should be paying attention to? Because if we want to change the quality of leadership, we have to change the quality of how we're raising these people who are hopefully going to grow up to be women in leadership.
Yeah. Gosh, such an interesting question and a few thoughts that occur to me. When you speak about voice, I read the most poignant Arundhati Roy quote the other day. She said, there's really no such thing as the voiceless. There's only the deliberately silenced or the preferably unheard.
Wow.
Oh, gosh, is that not the truth?
Wow.
And so who are we preferably unhearing? And who are we deliberately silencing? And how do we do that to each other? And, you know, it's interesting, Zah, because I've been watching with my niece. I have one niece in South Africa and one niece in New Zealand, and the rest are all nephews.
Yes.
And it's been very interesting to sometimes catch myself in how I talk to Jess, my niece, who I see more often than Olivia.
Yes.
How I talk to her and what I expect of her compared to what I expect of the nephews. And to just catch myself in that. And to be aware of my own biases and my own continuation. I had it with my goddaughter 2 or 3 years ago. I mean, Susan's fabulous. She's 23. She's getting her PhD in Denver, originally from Mozambique, came to South Africa. We looked after her for 5 years. Long story.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I remember saying to my mother when I was 16, I don't think I'm ever going to have kids. I love children. I can't imagine a life without children in it. But I don't think I want my own children. And my mom was like, you're 16. What do you know?
Yes.
Well, you know, I never did have children. I have nieces and nephews and godchildren and kids that we're guardians to, but not my own.
Yes.
And blow me down. But Susan says to me a few years later, you know, Niv, I don't think I'm going to have kids. My first instinct was, you're so young. Where is this coming from? What is this rubbish? And thank heavens I could catch myself in the moment. But I mean, you know, I was like looking at myself and looking back at myself and thinking, what the actual, you know? So I think for each of us to have that conversation with ourselves, to be aware of ourselves. And then I think it's as much how we raise our daughters, our nieces, as we raise the sons.
Yes.
Obviously. And I adore my youngest sister's way of raising the kids. I mean, she's only got 3 sons.
Yes.
She says it's karma because if she had had a daughter, it would have been payback for all the things that she put my parents through. She's the youngest. I'm the oldest.
Yeah.
But she is having very frank conversations with her boys, who are now teenagers, around women's bodies, around menstruation, around the fact that, you know, maybe you should have a vasectomy until you're ready to have kids, because the things that happen for women in terms of what they have to do to their bodies to stop pregnancies.
Yes.
And I just thought, you know, and interestingly, in that moment, the first reaction from my side was, that's a bit awkward. And then I thought, no, this is absolutely nonsense. 50% of people on this planet are going to menstruate. There would be no life on this planet if we did not do it.
Exactly.
I did not choose this. Trust me, I think it is a very fundamental and serious design flaw. But why is this shameful taboo? And even saying it now on this podcast, I'm this feels excruciating.
No, but I am loving it.
I am loving it
because here's what I'm hearing you say. I'm hearing you say, we also have to unhear the things that we were fed when we were coming up. I was 12, by the way, when I decided I'd be child-free. And like you, I was told I changed my mind. I fired 3 OBGYNs who continued to say to me, you're going to change your mind. I said, you're my medical practitioner, you're not a parent.
Wow.
And there's a place where people overstep the mark when they don't understand politics of the body and how you and I, who are born female, have to contend with people telling us what to do with our bodies. So it's a wonderful thing that your sister's having this conversation with your nephews, because if she didn't have that biological process, they wouldn't be here. In the same way that I find we're not having conversations in leadership roles about another biological process, which is menopause, right? So I'll give you an example. I'm at a bank. I'm a senior member of the bank, and we're having a boss barade in some very fancy London hotel. And my body does what it does. I can feel the wave rise from my toes, right? And then literally it just breaks on your face and you're showered with water. It's called a hot flush. And I see two colleagues truly shake on my behalf. So I don't know what's going on. I see them from the corner of my eye. I'm like, get on with yourself. I wipe my brow and I keep it moving.
Male colleagues or female colleagues?
Female colleagues. At the end of the conversation, they both come up to me and one gives me a blue pill and she says, "Hey Zara, hi, these saved my life." I'm like, "What are those?" She goes, "Oh no, I take them. This is HRT." I said, "Darling, I am happy that you have chosen that path for yourself. But let me tell you two things. One is, I will never be ashamed of a biological process, because this is what happens when your body changes. And two, I am not going to buy into the narrative that says aging is problematic. I am not aging. I'm getting older. And there's a very clear difference for me. It's getting older is a function of biology. Getting old is a function of attitude. So if you are feeling old, that's on you, because I'm going to rock my mini and I'm off to the dance floor."
Oh, that's fabulous.
So this area that you're talking about with politics is that I also see it when it comes to the reproductive choice you and I have made, because my work is about identity, right? Whether it's the identity of the individual, the identity of the brand, the identity of a corporation, but it's about identity making and meaning construction. So I'm interested in whether female leaders are also aware of how we other one another on the account of the personal choices we have made. When we had a bring a girl child to work day, I'd say, "I'm taking the day off because I don't have a child to bring." You know, like, "No, you can't take the day off. You've got to bring someone up." "But you have just said it must be my child. I have a goddaughter. Can I bring her?" "No." "Okay, I'm going to take the day off." So you have the design of policy that can be exclusionary. And I'm wondering whether in your conversation with female leaders, these are the things they're thinking about, not just diversity as in let's bring in more females or let's bring in more females who are black, but truly, truly going to the nuances of inclusivity as opposed to just the performative things that we're seeing around the world. What's your sense? What's been your experience?
So interestingly, I haven't had those kinds of conversations. I reflect a lot on my thoughts around this, but the women leaders that I've been speaking to, that hasn't come up in conversation in the last few years. Certainly it came up when I was at the Business Women's Association, and I think this othering,
okay,
spot on. And I think there's a range of things here to think about. The one is, I remember reading a few years ago, I was still at the South African Reserve Bank, and I was reading something from the Bank of England. And a report came out and said that the British economy was menopausal.
Yes.
And I looked at it and said, menopausal? And they went on to explain, I mean, somebody had obviously asked them to clarify as well, yeah, the way that I was when, yes, I'd read this report, or it was a press conference. I can't remember the exact details. I just remember the content. And this person, this highly technical central banker, "Yes, the British economy has passed its best and most productive years." And I thought, this is the 21st century. This is in an environment that is very technical. You know, there's a lot of care and concern around language and how we include people. And you've just said that with a straight face. And this is the metaphor out of all the metaphors available to you in the English language, or all the metaphors you could invent. This is the one you got. Past your best and most productive years. And I thought,
yes,
you know, does that not say just volumes? And I think, yeah, this othering of women who have had kids and therefore obviously their IQs dropped 10 points when they come into a meeting.
Yes.
Or women who have not had kids because they're just selfish.
Yes.
And they're just out there to, you know, conquer the world.
Yes.
Gosh, I mean, surely this is about giving people the right to choose what makes sense for them and supporting them in that choice. And interestingly, I posted something I don't often,
yeah,
very seldom, I post something deeply personal, and I never post on LinkedIn on the weekend. But on Mother's Day, I suddenly thought, inspired to acknowledge my mother, and,
yes,
and I put it up there, and a beautiful photograph of her, and I just said, you know, as they say, if it's not one thing, it's your mother.
Yeah.
And so here's my mother, and she's just fabulous. And so happy Mother's Day to my mother. Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers that I know. But also happy Mother's Day to all of those of us who know that mother is as much a verb as it is a noun.
Yes.
And that capacity to be maternal in the best possible way, to be nurturing and supportive. I mean, I think that extends to all of us, male and female, whether we have kids or not.
Yes.
And that becomes, gosh, a place of possibility as opposed to, oh, shame, you know, the eggs have shriveled up and you're having hot flushes. Are you kidding me?
Yes.
I'm past my best and most productive years.
Really?
Give me a blunt steak knife right now because I'm going to commit violence. Right, that's because I'm a menopausal.
Yes, your hormones are out of control. So that's exactly why you're going to be doing this. But I think part of what we're discussing, people may think these are not the nubs that leaders are dealing with. But you and I think share the understanding, which is the extent to which we are self-aware improves the quality of our leadership. Because it's not just who am I, but who am I in this environment? Who am I in relation to others? Who am I in relation to people who have influence? Who am I in relation to people who have attributes that I might like to grow into? So then you get either mentors or sponsors or ambassadors or advocates or what, or any other term that's chosen in the world of work today. I imagine me as a 25-year-old. I've graduated at the top of my class. I've been recruited by a management consulting practice because they wanted the best ones and they found me. What are the things I should be thinking about as I answer yes to that invitation? Because what you're sharing with me now is the world has shifted. So even as a 25-year-old, I can't just say I was top of my class at varsity, therefore I'm going to be top of my class at this particular organization. What are the things you think I should be reflecting on?
I think actually even before you take on that position, there's a few things you should reflect on. And it's almost impossible when you're a 25-year-old and you and I are both the first and, you know, wow, gosh,
yes.
I'm getting the thumbs up from this. Now, this is quite affirming and really quite nice. Yeah? And I have a friend who a few months ago was interviewing for a very senior executive position. And the bonus and the salary and the span of control and all the requirements were important. I mean, of course, she had conversations around that.
Yes.
But ultimately, they became entry to the game. And the deciding factor for her was the answer to the question that she asked herself, which was, do I want to become like these people?
Yes.
Do I want to become like these people? And frankly, if the answer is no, run like hell.
Yes.
Well, what are you doing to yourself?
Yes.
But if the answer is yes, then what are the parts of you that are inviolate and that you're going to hold on to and take with you in all organizations? And then which are the parts that need to flex?
Mm-hmm.
Because in this culture, in this way, you're going to need to find how you're going to be effective. And that may require a whole bunch of things. If being effective requires fundamental trade-offs, well, then we've got a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's about saying, okay, in this context, what does it take to be effective? And am I prepared to do it to not only become like these people, but also influence these people? You know, the kind of give and take when you go into an organization. I mean, that then becomes very interesting. And I remember when I joined the Reserve Bank, how I had to modify my behavior. I was still the same person, but all the things that had served me incredibly well as the CEO of two organizations, no, dial it down and dial it back, Niven, because here, let's make things happen. Let's make a decision.
Yes.
It's not appropriate. And so all the things that your boards have loved about you suddenly are getting a few people looking at you with tweezer lips thinking, is she trying to run the bank?
Yes.
And they were absolutely right. In that context, I was very proud to be there. I didn't necessarily want to become exactly like those people, but I wanted to be effective. And I'm forever proud of having been there. And so I think there's a number of things you've got to ask yourself before. And like I said, once you're in there, of course, what you know before and what you know when you're in the role are always different. You'll only fully know when you're actually in the role.
Yeah.
But again, it's about, you know, what am I prepared to do here to be effective in what ways? And how might I flex and learn and not just fit the culture? Because
yes.
This is the mantra, come and fit the culture. No, no, how do I contribute to this culture?
Yes.
That's a different thing. How do I recognize and respect it enough to want to be part of it, but also want to push the boundaries?
Yes.
Not overthrow everything, otherwise you're probably in the wrong place and you're not going to get much support, but contribute. And it's always about the people and the purpose and the impact and the degree to which it's aligned with who you are and who you want to be and who you see yourself becoming. I had a friend, such a dear friend, one of my oldest friends, a few years ago, had a terrible nervous breakdown. And I was so moved when she went to, I mean, she had a psychiatrist and a psychologist and an occupational therapist.
Yes.
Occupational therapist, what's that about? But out of all the help that she got, and I mean, now she's absolutely fine and flourishing again. But it was this occupational therapist who sat down with her. And instead of asking, yeah, she's presenting with major depression and a real breakdown. Instead of asking, what's the matter with you? This OT's first question is, what matters to you?
Yes.
And frankly, if what matters to you is being yes. ignored and trampled on every day,
yes.
Something is going to give.
Yes.
So many thoughts. I'm sure I could have even more that I could throw at you, but those are the ones that came to mind.
But also, you are asking us to do this following. You're asking us to pause and have a clear understanding of what's required of us and what we're willing to give and what we're not willing to give, right? So what came out for me is this idea that agility is not self-abandonment.
Oh, beautiful. I love it.
Because sometimes you think being flexible means I must give everything they want. No. It can't be at the expense of yourself, right? Because I remember when I finally had an opportunity to sit with the CEO of this bank at which I worked, and I asked them, what sort of person succeeds here? And they didn't answer the question, but I didn't know that they didn't answer the question because I'd already fallen in love with the challenge, right? And that's another thing that I think as young people we have to look out for, like, don't fall in love with the challenge, right? Understand the culture, because your ability to deliver against that challenge is truly, truly predicated on the culture in which that challenge exists. The second piece was, much like you, incredibly enthusiastic, and I always want to make an influence wherever I am. I mean, I decided on the term influence to be my North Star long before it became a conversation on social media about being an influencer. But I always just choose places where I think I can be of influence, and I know I am going to leave when I feel that my circle of influence is shrinking. In this particular instance, literally, I could feel myself move from a grape to a raisin. And the clinch, I guess, was a conversation when I was then told, you are not the CEO of this bank. And I knew that I wasn't, but I also had no desire to become the CEO of the bank. But what that communicated to me was, you see me as competition, and I see myself as a contributor. We are on two different planets here. So by the time that relationship ended, there was a lot of pain on my part, because it, at some point, it made me question my ability to be part of a team. Right, because you do, however independent you are in your own constitution, you also want to feel that you can be part of a team. So I did take some personal knocks and just reflecting on, am I really good with other people? Can I play nicely with other people? Or who are the people that I play nicely with? To your point, right, of do I want to be like these people? Which is a very important question. But you just reminded me of that question, because the thing I did ask, though, was, if I'm the first creative hire, will I be the only crazy in the zoo? Because it can get lonely. And I was told, no, we want you specifically for your craziness. And I said yes. And much like you, or much like any other person who knows what it's like to be liked for laughing loud. And once you say yes, then they say you please that just lower your volume, just use your inside voice. So every day truly felt like I was just shredding water and slowly moving from that grape to that raisin. So I'm grateful for that lesson, because just like you and I are sharing now, we're offering these things as examples for other people to watch out. Of course, I know when you're 25 and somebody who's 50 is telling you this stuff, you go, oh God, that's your problem, you know, boomer, sit down. Yes, and the world is different. Da, da, da. No. The world still revolves around the same things. For as long as there are human beings, there will be politics. And as long as there are politics, you will be called upon to reflect, to overcome, to engage, and to deliver in all these interesting ways, right?
100%. And, you know, I think at the same time, there are some things you can only learn by going through. And you know what? Going through can be a crucible experience that just reminds you yet again what actually matters. It can be a redemptive experience because you reinvent yourself at the end. It can certainly be an incredibly powerful experience in terms of empathy, in terms of really, I get this from the inside, not just nodding sympathetically from the outside. And I've always said to friends of mine, gosh, I think that must be the hardest thing for a parent to get right, is what are the mistakes that your child has to make, you know, even in their 20s and 30s, because this is the only way they're going to learn.
Yes.
The only way they're going to craft their character and sense of discipline and what they want and what they don't want, you know, personally, professionally, in relationships. What are the mistakes that you've just got to let your child learn from and step back and say, And then which are the ones you rush in to rescue them from and say, this one will take you down a path that's going to be very difficult to come back from. You know, I think that is an enormous dilemma. I mean, I can see one or two relationships that I had to have to learn from.
Yes.
And then I can see other members of my family, those relationships ruined their life.
Yes.
How do you know where it's going to end up? And so being aware, not being sucked in, not suddenly waking up after 20 years with golden handcuffs and creeping non-choices, and making the choices that are consistent with what most matters to you. I think, you know, that's an ongoing practice. Mm-hmm. And I'm not, again, by any stretch of the imagination, saying that the only way for fulfillment is to do your own thing. Nonsense. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know many fulfilled people doing many different things. There are multiple paths open to each of us.
Yes.
Take the path, reflect on the path, constantly check the path. And like I say, make sure that you're on the path that you thought you wanted to be on when you first started, because that will twist and turn and you will change. And so where does that leave you?
But also when you're on that path, right, always have the constant conversation with yourself, which is, am I becoming a better version of myself or am I becoming removed from myself? Yeah. But if people have got school fees, Niven, really, to pay, are you saying they must just abandon their big paying jobs and just go and find themselves? What are you saying? How much punishment should people absorb?
Yeah, so Zad, this is so personal, so contextual, so up to each person to make sense of. And far be it from me to give anybody a blanket instruction for their life, precisely because it's their life, you know. I suppose the thing that strikes me often, though, and the things that people find interesting about the choices that I've made and been able to make are a couple of things. One, I was lecturing to some up-and-coming executives at a bank the other day, and the one person was saying, yeah, but, you know, the challenge here in terms of going on to do things that we might also want to do is there's so many lines of credit that are given to us. And it's so appealing. So you take them and then suddenly you can't afford to leave.
Yes.
And that's not just at their level. I mean, at the same bank, I know a number of people who work there. We're talking very senior levels.
Yes.
Where the bonuses are so large, they get paid out in two or three tranches. And those bonuses are spent before they've even been gotten. You know, so this is not just people who are trying to pay the bills.
Yes.
This is people who've got plenty of money to pay plenty of bills.
Yes.
They've spent that bonus before they've gotten it. And so, you know, we then got into a long discussion around black text, which I think is huge and real, and I can't possibly speak to. It's not part of my frame of reference. But you ignore the reality of it, the social pressure, the financial pressure of that. I think at your peril. As anybody trying to understand what other people are going through, and as the person who's going through it and who might be drowning under the weight of these expectations and obligations. And I think it's up to each of us to figure out which of these things are real. They're real, valid reasons, and I recognize them as such, and I live with them. And then which of them are excuses?
Yes.
And it sounds like a hell of a convincing and compelling reason. It's actually, in my case, in my instance, an excuse. And you know, kids often come up with this one. And I read such a fabulous interview in The U the other day. People think it's hilarious that I read The Atlantic, The New Yorker, The Financial Times, and The U. But I think
and you should.
Flipping good at being
it's a balancing act.
Yeah, and it's a zeitgeist of
things. Yes, of course.
Anyway, so they had an article a few months ago about this family whose daughter was severely disabled. And of course, for many people, that would be the reason that they're going to stay put and make sure that she gets all the best care that she possibly can, because who knows how long she's going to live. For this family, it was the reason they were going to take her to see the world.
Awesome.
They were going to up their jobs. They were going to do whatever they wanted to give this child the fullest possible life for as long as she had. And again, who am I? I can't possibly cast any judgment on that or on other people's lives. But interestingly, how many times kids are excuses as opposed to reasons. Reasons instead of excuses. You know, I think this is something only you can answer. And hopefully you ask yourself and then you live with whatever answer comes to you.
Isn't that incredible? I mean, you've just reminded me of the book The Choice by Edith Egger. Because she also speaks to how some people may have survived the Holocaust and some people may have embraced life, right? So this is exactly the point you're making, which is how do you see and how do you frame your experiences? Because if it's asset framing, then you're out there going, here are the ways in which this thing can be wonderful. But if it's deficit framing, then it is, here's the ways which these things are limiting. But I love that. I love that you are challenging not just those of us in leadership positions outside of corporate or inside corporate, but also those of us who are in leadership positions in our families, right? Because leadership is not a come to this building on Main Street and you will therefore be a leader. Leadership is exercising your influence from wherever you are. And that could be as a big sister, it could be as an only brother, it could be in whichever sphere of life that you are. I was speaking to a group of women the other day and I said to them, is there a difference between leading like a woman and leading like a human?
Hmm.
And they looked at me and they said, what are you smoking? But it started a conversation, right? Because some people actually said, of course I lead like a woman. That's why I'm on this woman's leadership course. And then I said, so are you suggesting that your gender is, or at least your being is subservient to your gender? What are you saying? And it started a healthy conversation. And I'm wondering whether you think that there's a conversation to be had about the amount of emphasis we're putting on female leadership or women leaders, and whether in emphasizing and gendering that process of leadership, we are actually demoting their being. I don't know. I haven't formed a view. It's just a question I'm living with.
Yeah, and it's a powerful question, and I think there are so many strong debates on either side. I remember when I was at the Business Women's Association, on the one hand, a lot of pushback from a lot of women saying, do me a favor, I'm very good at what I do. That's my identity. The gender is secondary. Why are we, in your language, why are we leading with this?
Yes.
And then, of course, equally compelling evidence about the fall-off rate in organizations all across the world. Mm-hmm. Women start at equal levels and then suddenly disappear in the top ranks. How much of that is societal and systemic and the kind of second shift that most women have to work when they go home? And I've lectured to women all over the world, and cultures are vastly different. But you mentioned the second shift.
Yes.
And pretty much every woman knows what that means. I don't know what it means as a person without kids, but if I had elderly parents, if I was one of those sandwich generations where, you know, you're having kids later, so your kids are younger when you're older and your parents are living longer and you're having to look after both of those. I mean, that burden of unpaid care work falls to women. I remember sitting talking with many CEOs who were female, many of whom had house husbands. And they said, but when their child is sick, they want me. When something needs to happen with our parents, it's not my brothers. Yeah. I need to sort this out.
Yes.
And how much of that is a choice and how much of it is that an expectation from society, which we ignore at our peril because it's informing the reality of the context in which women are working. Mm-hmm. But no, you need to come to work and not just be an equally professional. Okay, but hold on a second. And so there's actually a fantastically interesting article that came out in Harvard Business Review in January called The Tolls that some, I'm going to butcher the title, but it's essentially about the tolls that some people pay at work yes. while others cruise on an open highway.
Yes.
And what I love about this is this metaphor of tolls is one that we can all relate to. And they talk about the other. So we can all be an other through gender, through race, through background, through language, through qualification, through all manner of things, through a strategic change where suddenly our focus and our abilities weren't as important as another focus and ability.
Yeah.
And so I love this idea that we can all sit on the outside of an in-group that's cruising the open highway and we're having to pay all these tolls. But of course, I think it disproportionately falls onto women and minorities around this toll, these tolls, and they're three. They talk about the toll of influence,
yes,
toll of opportunity, and then the toll of scrutiny, yes. where you're not seen as an individual, you're seen as, this is what women do.
Yes.
This is what Black women do.
Yes.
See, and especially when you're in the minority, this is what creatives do. Oh,
yes.
Bit much.
Yes.
You know, and so I think this is an ongoing debate. And I think it was Audre Lorde who said there's no such thing as a single issue struggle because none of us live single issue lives.
Yeah.
Am I primarily a human being in a world where sometimes, frankly, I'm ashamed to be a human being? Am I primarily a South African, a woman in her 50s? I mean, these are endless questions, you know.
Yes.
But you, I could speak to you for 10,000 years, but I suspect you have 10,000 other people to go and influence and just brighten their days. But this has been super, super fantastic. And I'm hoping you're going to come back because you've just dropped so many wisdoms. I'm sitting here going, we need another 10 sessions with Niven. Just so that we can truly just broaden this conversation. So before I let you go, I would like you to just reflect on if there was a thing you wanted leaders to know today, if there was a one thing you wanted leaders to know today, what would that be? Either something to know or something to do.
This comes from a good friend of mine, Fortune. She said it beautifully, and so I'll repeat her wisdom. She said, leaders get the behaviors that they demonstrate and that they tolerate.
Yes.
Connect those dots and then don't be surprised at what you're getting back at you in terms of a culture, in terms of delivery, in terms of an energy, in terms of all kinds of things.
And you could substitute leaders for parents, right? Leaders for anything, Wow. Mike dropped, as my goddaughter would say. She goes, Auntie Zara, shots fired. Thank you, darling. Can I use that? Yes, you can. But tell them I said it. So there we go. So Nala would have said, shots fired. So thank you so, so much for this delightful chat. And I'm hoping, of course, we need to have dinner and things that have some rotten grapes in them. But until we speak again on this platform, I wish you clarity and courage. And may the road rise to meet you, as always.
That's so lovely. Thank you.
Until soon. Take care. Bye.
From now on, Full Circle will be called Future Readiness with Zara, and we'll still have those thought-expanding conversations and the streams of encouragement that you enjoy. If you already subscribe to Full Circle with Zaa, you are automatically subscribed to Future Readiness with Zaa. And you can continue to listen to all the conversations on the podcast platform of your choice. But also let me know if there are any specific topics or guests you would like us to host. Enjoy, like, and share. And until the very next time, I wish you clarity and courage.